Welcome back to the second episode of The Scenario Sports. I'm your host, Matt Whitener. Happy to have you be here, be a part of the program today. Whether you're checking us out on the podcast version or checking out our live stream, happy to have you here on the Straight Out Low Cash Network, SOLC, all day. We got a lot of great programs on the network we're going to bring to you, and we're going to keep it coming to you with the new sports content here. Today, we're going to go and start getting to a little bit of a different direction with the show. We're going to be bringing in Jason Klinkscales, who's the editor-in-chief of the Sports Fan Journal. I've been a writer at the Sports Fan Journal for about 8 years now, and it's definitely a vehicle that's got a voice for young writers, definitely an ear to the culture, a lot of different ways that you can do it and hear from people who, you know, are on the way up. And that's, we're going to talk a little bit about that, but, you know, also focus on some of the things that are going on in the sports world, mainly around the NBA Finals that'll be getting underway tonight. Miami Heat and LA Lakers, probably not the matchup that I thought we'd have, but I think it's going to definitely be one of the more interesting finals that we're going to have. It's going to be kind of a collision of two different styles. So we're going to talk about that. And, it's impossible to talk about the Lakers and the Heat and not talk about LeBron James and, you know, what he means in this series and how that's gone throughout other areas of his career and brings us to this moment that he's going to be facing his whole team. So we'll talk a little bit about that and talk about a couple of other things with Jason. After that, we'll be joined by Chris and Christian Little. Christian is one of the top high school baseball players in the country. High school baseball player for now, because he's getting ready to start his career at Vanderbilt University as an early entrant. He'll be a 17-year-old pitching for Vanderbilt this spring. So I'm going to talk with him and also his father, Chris. Chris is also, a U City resident in my homeland. But also a professional pitcher in his own right as well. So talking about what that journey has looked like for both of them and also what that kind of plays by in the space of being a young African-American in a sport that isn't as dominant in having such African-American players in it right now. And, kind of how that looks for the future, how it plays into where we've been in the past with the sport and everything like that. So a good conversation there, and we'll be getting to that. I will say that we did record this episode before the Monday night showdown with Pat Mahomes and Lamar Jackson, with the Chiefs going over on the Ravens in a way I don't think anybody really predicted. So we have a little bit of conversation with Jason about that, but it's not going to be in the past tense because we recorded this before that game. But, interesting week for the NFL. I'll talk about that for a second here. We had the first COVID-19 related suspension or interruption with the Titans coming down with, I think, 8 people on their team, or team and staff came away infected with that. So interesting to see what happens now. The league is saying that they're going to move forward with the game and that they're going to probably either push it to the upcoming game this week between the Steelers and the Titans into either Monday or Tuesday. But, this is an inevitable outcome. It was something that's going to happen eventually. So curious to see, how the league pivots from this. We've definitely seen some of the massive interruptions that it had in Major League Baseball this year and just getting their feet on the ground with that. So we'll see where that goes and where that comes out. I have more commentary about that next week as we'll be seeing that come together in real time. Also, we're talking about baseball. The baseball playoffs got underway on Tuesday. Bigger field than ever. I think half the league is playing still at this point. So it's more or less of a process of elimination than it's ever been before. But, that's going to be a journey as well, about what that looks like and how the game is going to be pivoting into some of the new areas that it's got. So we'll keep an eye on that, keep an eye to the streets and where that's at as well. I will say that I'm curious to see how this works out. You've got a lot of teams that are in the mix that have never been there before, some names that you just aren't used to seeing in the position that they're in, whether that be the Tampa Bay Rays being the top team in the American League, or you've got the San Diego Padres have gotten in, at the Miami Marlins making a rise to get into the play. Some of this is obviously comes from the expanded playoff seats that are out there, but honestly it comes to some teams that are just coming up and rising in prominence this year. So I think there's going to be interesting outcome from that, especially with these 3 wild card rounds that are going on, 3 wild card games, I should say, that's going on to even get to what kind of that regular postseason format looks like. So we could have some surprises, have some interesting things come out of that, but we'll keep our eyes to the street on that and see how that works out. So I don't want to delay any longer. I want to get Jason in. I want to bring some of those things, get into some of the conversation we've had. And it's going to be it's going to be a good one. I think you're going to enjoy it. So stay locked. All right, and welcome back in to the Scenario Sports. Thanks for sticking with us here. Got a second part of today's episode that I definitely wanted to get in and make time to, you know, share some people. We're having some chat before we got on this about, you know, hometown roots and whatnot. If you know me, you know that's important. So take a second, man, and introduce my next guest here. We got Christian and Chris Little that are joining us here straight out of St. Louis. I'm going to get into y'all's story a little bit first and what that looks like. But, man, thank you for both of y'all for making time to join me here on the show.
All good.
All day, man. I appreciate it. So, you know, for those that don't know, and I think we'll get there by that time, amateur baseball is underserved in the big picture of what other amateur sports have looked like in my mind. You discover more players at the major league level than you do in almost any other sport. But the reality of it is that it's a longer grind to the top than there is for any other sport. You'll have the largest amount of people that start at one level that get there, and you don't hear from them again. And then, you know, everybody gets looked at as being an overnight success or sensation, but it's far from the truth. And, you know, and the reason why I was really excited to have y'all have an opportunity to join me today is that both of y'all have went down that pathway before. You know, Chris, back in your time, going through the minor league system, getting started, being a pro for the time that you were. Christian, for where you at right now, you know, getting started on your journey and moving forward in the sport. What's something that just in the general sense of being a baseball player do y'all find to be misunderstood the most by people?
You know what? I think the fact, like you said, you said it's an underserved sport. And the fact is it's hard to get traction, and it's hard to build a foundation because the younger levels and especially in our underserved communities, more of our you know, inner city communities, which where we basically came from, you don't have the same, there's not the same opportunities. There's not the same opportunities for development. There's not the same opportunities to play the type of schedule that typically puts these kids at an advantage as far as what our counterparts are doing in different parts of our cities and our state and country overall. So I think that's one piece that makes it difficult to get kids in from the beginning is more of the access to the right coaching and the right training and just overall direction of where a player could take the game of baseball.
Christian, I'll kind of pivot that question for you being earlier in your career and whatnot. You know, obviously, like every other guy, you started playing the game when you were young, you know, had a love for it, got into it. What have been some of the revelations you've had as you've climbed the ranks and have moved up and getting your career off the ground?
You know, like, basically piggybacking off of my dad, what he said is, like, it's just not, the opportunity isn't as present as you see in our communities as basketball and football are. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way Major League Baseball markets the game. They don't do as well of a job as the NBA or NFL does. And football and baseball, basketball seem more exciting, whereas baseball is kind of harder to seem exciting. It's a longer game. There's a lot that goes on. Little things matter more. And just trying to make the game more exciting, I think that could fix a lot of the issues with the viewpoint of baseball from a lot of people in our communities.
I think that thing you said about viewpoint, that carries a lot of credence too, because there's so many things that are going on that I think that just the average sports fan, even though I think a sports fan that knows above average amount about the game, different games and things like that, doesn't know the extent of what's happening in amateur baseball. You know, to put it out there, you know, to share a few of your accolades about where you're at in the class of 2021, which would be your class, your top three player in the country. You know, if you go back, let's flash back to a couple of other people that come out the area in St. Louis, Jason Tatum. You know, you look at what Brad Beal was doing. If you go way back in my days, these gray hairs grow up on me, Larry Hughes, you know, you couldn't miss it. Darius Miles, you couldn't miss it. But, you know, for where they were at, you're on the exact same par as where they were at in your sport. However, you know, it ties back to the professional game. It's not promoted as much. And I think that really plays a harder part in the African-American community, where it's harder than any other place to see people that look like you on the diamond.
Yeah, and to go off of that, like, everybody knows who Jason Tatum is, but do you know who Devin Williams is? He's in the running for the Rookie of the Year, reliever, black man, MLB from St. Louis, and don't nobody even know who he is.
Exactly. So,
getting those names out there to the youth is big.
And I think, Chris, I'll throw this to you, man. I think that, you know, and first of all, the point about Devin Williams, let's talk about him for a second. Hey, what a year, man. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like, earlier today, I was turning in my ballot for the Internet Baseball Writers of America, our awards ballot for the year. So I was turning that in, and I was looking at it, and I already knew that I was voting for him for Rookie of the Year in the National League. I was done already. But then I started looking at it like, man, does this dude need to be getting Cy Young votes? Like, he's literally, you know, I think that his ERA this year was 0.33. That's insane. That's insane, yeah. You know. But you don't hear about it. And you start to see pieces that come up on the local level as it happens. But at the rate of exposure that you have for baseball players in general, but definitely talented black baseball players that aren't in a massive market, they're in Milwaukee and things like that, even longer for that story to get out there. So I think that Devin Williams is a great example, because all things being called down the middle, that's a type of pathway that you could be in a position to walk yourself and still get to the highest level and still have more exposure to get at that point. And I think that's something that's got to change. And Chris, you know, we've spent, you know, decades and decades around the game. You know, when we were growing up, Ken Griffey, Barry Bonds, you know, Ozzy, all these guys, you know, the stars of the game were African-Americans, but somewhere along the way, we lost that way. What have been some of the things you've seen that have changed from, you know, when you and I were playing when we were younger to where you're seeing on the circuit now that Christian's going?
Well, first I'd like to start with what we see in the major leagues today. When we were growing up, you had plenty of black role players on a team. So we obviously knew who the all-stars were. We knew the Ozzie Smiths. We knew the Barry Bonds. We knew all of those guys. And yeah, I mean, we've had a very strong tradition here in St. Louis. So we haven't had a shortage of black superstars, you know, whether that's going back to, you know, Bob Gibson and God rest his soul, Lou Brock. You know, our community, our parents and their parents have always had that black superstar to root for. But where the game has changed is that you still have, you know, those black superstars in the game, but that's all you have in the game now. So it's almost at the point where if you're not a superstar, you don't have a job. There's not as many journeymen as there used to be. There's not that guy that is going to play multiple positions and he's going to bounce from team to team to team. But at the end of the day, he's going to rack up a 10-year career. Yeah. That's not happening now. You get a prospect that comes up. If you don't cut it, you're back down to AAA. Before you know it, you're out the game. You're playing indie ball somewhere. And I played quite a bit of indie ball, and there were guys that I was playing down there with, like, there's no way in the world that this guy is not having an opportunity to bounce back and at least be a role player in the big leagues. And I think that that's the biggest issue, because when we're talking about the total percentage of black players in the league, that's where that number for any player is going to be higher, because you're going to always have more role players than superstars as far as that number goes. And that's something that I feel like needs to change. And from seeing it on the youth level and being privy to be able to see outside of St. Louis, which we have very good talent here in St. Louis, but when you compare it to what we're seeing from the national level, I don't care if we're talking about baseball, I don't care if we're talking about my daughter plays high-level volleyball. When you get to playing around the best players in the country, there's many, many more of us, and they're coming. And so from sport to sport, you're going to see as that pyramid starts getting towards the top, it's kind of funny because you don't have as many of us at the bottom. But as you start getting towards the top, I mean, if you just look at the rankings in the 2021 class, half of the rankings in the top 10 are black players.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and if you're looking at the draft, it's the same way.
And that's a remarkable turn of fortune that I think has started to happen, that there's a lot of ways you could package baseball. And I think that we're all privy to the way that a lot of people talk about it. Hey, go get that baseball money. You know what I'm saying? Go, hey, that's guaranteed. You know, that football, you don't know if that's going to last and that. But there's a lot more to it than that, though, right? And I think that the thing that really stands out to me, it's a two-pronged thing. When I watched the NFL last week, we were one quarterback away from the entire afternoon slate, Sunday night and Monday being Monday. Who played Monday last week? Can't remember. Yes, Monday as well, being all black quarterbacks. That would have taken a year to fill out, you know, if we would have done it even two, three seasons ago. But now we're starting to have that turn of fortune some. However, in baseball, there's still some things that stand out about the sport that really raise an eyebrow for me, to say the least. Namely, the lack of black pitchers. Namely, the lack of black catchers. Try to find an amazing black third baseman. Not just right now, but go back 30, 40 years. You're going to almost have to go to Bill Matlock, Harry Pendleton, guys like that. It's few and far between. Charlie Hayes, whose son is playing for the Pirates now and had a pretty damn good year himself too, you know, is going to be a star in this game. But I say all of that to say there's a huge inequity in the opportunity that's put out for African-Americans to play positions like pitcher, like catcher, and things like that. So as y'all are going around on the circuit and seeing things like that, are you encouraged by not just the spread of black talent that's coming around and being in at all positions, but being in roles like pitcher and being behind the plate and having other things like that?
Yeah, as far as like the black talent at the youth level for pitchers and catchers, there's a lot of them in my class, at least. Like we got Ian Moeller, number one catcher in the country. We got Harry Ford. He's a top five rounder this year. And we got Andreas Lewis, who's another one of those guys that are catch position that are black. Pitchers, there's not many black pitchers like in the major leagues, really. I'm sure you can name all on the finger that are starting pitchers in the MLB that are black. But you see guys coming up like McKenzie from Cleveland, who's putting on the show. You see guys like Stroman, obviously, who's going to bring that flair and that African culture towards the game. You got Tim Anderson, obviously, who's basically putting the culture of baseball on his back and carrying it right now. So, I mean, as far as, like, a lot of people like to say baseball is boring, but the game is starting to change, and that flair is starting to sort of come into the game.
I've been encouraged. I'm glad you bring up Tim Anderson. I've been encouraged by the fact that it would almost be a crime for him not to be a top five MVP guy this year.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he came within inches of being a back-to-back batting champion. You know, something that we haven't had since, it's been a long time since we had that, and especially being an African-American player at that. But, you know, Christian, we talked about this before, about how the moment of this year has also put African-American players in a different light. But, you know, I feel like still, even at this time, their voices aren't heard as much as the ones that you hear from the NBA and that you hear in the NFL and whatnot. But all the while, they've been some of the loudest ones that have been out there. So for you coming into the game and, you know, being at the level that you're at right now, what's it like to be somebody that people are looking to and you have something to say, you know, about that? But, you know, just living the life that every black man is at this time and balancing that responsibility with what you're doing on the field as well.
Trying to make sure you put the right image out there and be the best possible model you can be. You want to use your platform as well to get the message across. And but you as a black man, I feel like you're obligated to do that as far as to put up your message or how you feel about everything going on. I know a lot of people that are kind of like quiet about it, don't want to really talk about it, tap dance around it because they feel like they're going to get criticized about it or crucified by scouts or whatever. But I feel like that's just a sacrifice we have to make as far as being black men in America and really how much worse did it get.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at this point, I mean, if you've got a platform, whatever it is you can stand on, let your voice come from the top of it. And I think that because you see people like Tim Anderson and people like Jack Flaherty, people like Josh Bell, you know, Amir Garrett, who is most certainly not apologizing for anything that he puts out there, and I love it. Jason Haywood, Dexter Fowler, walking off, you know, before the game, getting late scratches when the Bucks did their protest and called off the game there. Baseball, I'll be honest, you said the thing you said earlier about Major League Baseball not promoting it itself as well. Baseball was the sport I was the most worried about as you were starting to see some of these protests and things go out there, because I said baseball can't blow this moment. because I see it as being an opportunity for people to look at the sport in a way that maybe they haven't in a long time. And, you know, you have, there's moments right now we just haven't had presented. Chris, we're just talking about the 90s, you know, and talking about what things looked like. I mean, you even delved into the 60s and 70s when, you know, it was a whole different world for African Americans in the game. And it was a time when the players would say what they needed to say. You had your Frank Robinson, who anybody that's not well versed on Frank Robinson, please do it, because that's literally the history of what that looks like. I'll tell y'all a story. I probably 5-6 years ago or so, I was at the Negro League Baseball Museum in Kansas City, and they had a panel with Frank Robinson, with Hank Aaron, and Dave Winfield was the moderator. The question I asked was, you know, what do you think that baseball could do better to get more African Americans involved in it? He said, you could put it in front of them, give them the opportunity to play, make it happen. Because, you know, my experience growing up was is that you get to a certain level and you start seeing less of us. You know, you could always play, you know, in the city leagues and things like that. You could stay there forever, but you know you have to leave that to go to another place. So, you know, Chris, as you were starting to take the journey with Christian and the things that he was doing and seeing some of the levels and the players that were there, what's that experience like when you start to just get into that other world so early? And Christian, I think that's a question for you as well. You start to get into that world so early where it's not just you. You're leaving away from that and having to balance that being maybe the exception just due to the color of your skin.
Yeah, like growing up, like when I was younger, I was always on all black teams. And as I got better, I was on obviously all white teams. Mm-hmm. And as I got even better and I moved down, started playing down south on a national level, there's a lot more of us than you would ever think. Like, there's a lot more at the highest level than you think there is. And that was kind of comforting to see and to have around. There's not many of us in St. Louis, but down south, there's a lot more.
I think a lot of it, honestly, is it's a regional thing. You know, I mean, obviously we're from St. Louis. Anybody from St. Louis understands what those barriers look like. They understand kind of, you know, what our people's struggle have been here in this town. And the reality is that, you know, baseball is not an attractive sport that the last generation. So honestly, the generation right before us, Matt, those parents didn't hold on to that tradition like some of their parents and their parents and so on. Because at one point, baseball was the sport for black people. If you look, you mentioned the Negro Leagues. If I tell anybody, go take a look at what those all-star games used to be, what they used to look like with the Negro Leagues. Look who used to come out. We were clean. Every celebrity that you can think of, everybody that you've watched, you listen to their music, you watch them on TV, everything. Yo, they there front row. They out there. If they singing, they out there singing. If they dancing, they're out there dancing on the dugouts. There's strong tradition in the Negro League. And so that's what, and our people embrace the sport. We always embrace the sport. Obviously, you've got other sports that have become more attractive for us. Some of that is because, you know, it's, guess what? College, pro. There is no in-between. There is no minor league to go through when you're dealing with NBA, when you're dealing with the NFL. And I think most of it just ends up coming down to just a lack of development, training and coaches and how to develop players. When we were coming up playing, you know, in the Matthew Dickey leagues and RBI baseballs and things like this, God love them, we had great dad coaches that cared, spent time with us. But from a training and development side, you know, there weren't as many that understood the nuances and the detail of how to train a player. Mm-hmm. If you look at, we'll go back to when you're talking about certain positions in the MLB. If you look at the trickle-down effect, if you look at the positions that black players typically keep, they're the most athletic positions. Center field, shortstop, second base, you'll get your outfield positions. But typically corner infield guys, you don't see them as much, you know, because we're looked at as the athletic type, you know, we're the scrappy type. You know,
if you're going to have one, use them for what they use them for. Exactly. The biggest skill spread.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that there's certain things that have kind of come along with that throughout the years. But let's just be honest. Most people, most of your superstars, most of your big time players either were a shortstop, a pitcher. At some point they became a center fielder. They were premium positions on the field. And when they got to certain levels, and they had to move over, that's whenever you'll see them at other positions. So I feel like that's coming, and that's coming back. And MLB is doing a great job to highlight these young players at young ages through the Breakthrough Series and through the Dream Series, and allowing these young men to have the opportunity to learn from veterans and to kind of that roadway and that path that had been blocked for so many years. It's starting to reopen, and so that information is starting to be passed down to these younger players through our veteran players that have been playing the game, through coaches like myself, through people that have been there, played the game, and have that experience, and can now help, as these young players are starting to take off in their journeys.
For sure, absolutely. And talking about taking off in that journey, you mentioned a couple of things there, like the Dream Series and things of that nature. Another thing I'll throw out there is like the Hank Aaron Invitational and things of that nature. Christian, what's it like for you, you know, being not just, you know, a participant in that, but being one of the main people that people are pointing to as an example of, you know, what those type of events and what those type of camps and experiences can produce?
I'll be honest, it's like you get there and same as everybody else, really. Like you don't think about it like that way. So you get there, everybody is just, obviously, when you get that black culture around baseball, this is the most fun you're going to have. It is definitely different than when you go to USA baseball events and it's predominantly not African Americans there. It's just a different feeling. You got all the black coaches there. You're learning more about your heritage. You eat your own food. It's a lot different than normal baseball where blacks are the minority in that.
And it's an interesting thing, too, that you point that out, because I can recall a couple of years ago, like at the World Baseball Classic, and with the big conversation and the big thing that people were debating was the differences in the style of play. You know, people were upset at the Dominican team and at the Puerto Rican teams and whatnot for, you know, being so loud throughout the game and flipping bats and things like that. But when you talk about that in the baseball culture, you know, the differences in environments, it's just the reality. So that's why I think that the fact that it gets framed as being something that's divergent or different or something, that's a big overcome that I think has to happen too, is to realize that this game of baseball, it's not just a linear thing. It's not just played one way. Different people go about doing it different ways. And I think that's one of the things that lack of individuality, and lack of expression is something that might have hurt the game in the eyes of African Americans, especially younger African Americans like yourself.
Yeah, because it's missing that excitement that attracts the black eye. And I feel like, because if you look at social media, Bryce Harper has the most followers on social media out of any baseball player. I think he has like 1 million. Mm-hmm. You go to high school basketball. You know how many players in high school basketball have like 13 million followers?
Right.
It's just excitement, even from a youth level, it just isn't there. And that's something that baseball has to fix and create an agenda around.
Well, you know what? There's two versions of Yadier Molina. Now, depending on, you know, which side you're used to watching him from, you'll be able to say, hey, no, this is real Yadier. You've got the St. Louis Cardinal version of Yadier.
Yeah.
He's the Cardinal way. And it's not that there's anything wrong with how he goes about his business, because his career has been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the Puerto Rican team, Yadier Molina. And if you watch how he played with the Puerto Rican team, that's who Yadi came up as. That's who Yadi is. Now, every now and then, depending on how the situation goes in a game and if he gets too fired up, you're going to see that version of Yadi. And that's what the fans love. They love to see that Yadi. But that Yadi is, that's every day when he's playing with that Puerto Rican team and when he's coming up playing the game, because that's how they know how to play. And I'm going to take it back to the Negro Leagues, because at the end of the day, the Negro Leagues, they were the ones, they would go down to the Caribbean during the winter and play. Okay. They introduced the game. If you ask, I can't tell you how many guys when I was playing, how many Dominican players felt like Satchel Paige was their favorite player. Yo, this was like 2001, 2, 3, 4. This is not about 70s and 60s and the 50s. This is their tradition. Satchel Paige, black man. When they went down there and played the game, it's entertainment. Yeah. And so the Negro Leagues had that part down. It was entertainment. It wasn't showing up, guys. It's no different than if you go to a street ball game and you watching White Man Can't Jump. And the whole way that we're playing, and the mouthy, and we're challenging you. And guess what? We're gonna let you know when we do you in. And that's the way the game was. So guess what? When they took that down to the Caribbean, and those players got to see those men in action, that has lived on. That Negro League style of baseball, you can see that if you turn it on. You know, I don't know what stations you might have, but you know, ESPN Plus will show the Caribbean World Series, and the energy, the excitement. When you get the chance to watch these guys, you know, when we've been privy to be able to see the game at the youth level from the international circuit, being with the USA team. And those young players, they play with that type of swag. You know, it's what makes the game exciting.
And, like to talk about that is, like, a lot of our players do want to do that, but I feel like coaches, usually the older ones, the old way, the old school coaches, kind of take that away from the player. Like you watch other sports, they got drip. You got things they can do to dress how they want to. We don't get to do that. It's just like there's so many things missing in baseball that are in other sports that add excitement, and they need to find a way to integrate that into the game.
Christian, what do you see as being the difference between, you know, the game, and you obviously are in the midst of where it's going to be going over the next few years, compared to like 5 years ago, you know? So let's even go back a little further than that. Let's go back to, you know, like maybe when Albert Pujols and those guys were, you know, running wild, you know, in St. Louis, compared to where the game is at now. Do you feel a difference in how you see the black presence and how it's parlayed in the game? And how much do you think that leap is going to take over the next 5 to 10 years as well?
I feel like the game, there's always been a standard way to play the game. And I feel like players now are starting to shake that up, even non-black players, like Fernando Tatis, a Latin player, breaking unwritten rules in the game, kind of just shaking the game around. You got even white players are doing the same thing, integrating things that weren't seen as things you should do or that weren't respectful in competition. But I just know that there's a wave of black players coming at the youth level, and we're hungry, and we're not going to stop till we get to the top. And it's going to continue to change. And I'm saying, give it like 20 years, baseball will be up there as far as excitement and entertainment with the NBA and NFL.
That's a powerful thing to hear, because when you just look at the last week we're at here on the business side, you know, baseball signs another $3 billion rights deal, you know, for people that say things like, you know, oh, baseball is going to die, baseball is going to do this. Listen, baseball is not going anywhere. There's networks fighting to spend $3 billion on it in the middle of a pandemic. You know, on this side of the culture, 2 points here. The top two selling jerseys in baseball, two African-Americans, Mookie Betts going over the top this year, going over Aaron Judge, who had held it for the last 3 years. Now, obviously, it helps being in L.A. and New York. That's a phenomenal head start, to say the least. You know, yes. But I mean, you have that there, and that still are people that you can point at and say that. But, Chris, to your point that you made about increasing the bench depth, you know, and having more people that get that repeat opportunity to stay in the league and to continue to color those teams out like that, I truly think that's going to be the key to taking the numbers up from the low levels that they're at and have hit a low in recent years that have been akin to the years right after integration, you know, 60-something years ago. So, you know, on one hand, for me, I call the game accountable. You know, I turned on the game the other day. It was the Cardinals playing the Royals. It was the St. Louis Stars against the Kansas City Monarchs, because I've got a St. Louis Stars shirt on right now.
Yes.
But it's like, when I look at that, And these ain't the cats that was wearing the uniforms, though. Now, it's remarkable to see a lot of Latin and white players wearing Negro League uniforms, you know what I'm saying? I mean, respect. But I want that game to look a little bit more like how it was originally played. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, Seattle, the Mariners, who lead the major leagues in black players, unfortunately, they're in that West Coast time zone. They're Northwest. You know, it's tough to catch those games. But obviously always rooting that team and that organization on, because as these younger players continue to make names.
Yeah.
And once they get to free agency, and you can start seeing them around the country and in some of your bigger venues, I think that it's going to continue to grow. And I think that, honestly, I think that with social media, I think players are getting more savvy about how to promote themselves and promote their and promote not just their brand, but promote them as players in a game that honestly has not done a very good job of promoting them. So I think that the more that these young players learn how to use that platform, learn how to tell their stories, you know, and learn how to control their narrative, those followers will continue to grow. And the great thing about social media is you can give more of yourself than just the game. So you can gain attraction from other things that you're into off the field because you already have such a large platform. So the more people that can be reached because these young players are starting to get better with how they use their social media and how they prepare their platforms, I think that you're going to find more people that are going to come in and root for someone, not because I love the game of baseball, but because I love this person. I like who this person is. They represent me. You know what I mean? I want my little brother. I want my son. I want my daughter to want to look at these guys and say they're doing it the right way.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And go ahead, man.
And, like, to piggyback off of that, basically, like, to, like, in that idea is, like, there is, like, everyone knows there's a shortage of black players in the MLB, and, like, us as black players, we're not asking to be put into the MLB. We're just asking for equal opportunity because the opportunities are not always equal, and that's been very apparent. You get a player exactly the same, white player and a black player, who you think they're going to choose? They do the exact same things, who you think they're going to choose? We're just asking for opportunity, more opportunity. Equal opportunity.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, the thing that you said that makes me the most excited is, you know, about the amount of people that are coming up, you know, and the people that are there, the people that you see through the rankings, you know, when you're picking up, you know, Baseball America, Baseball Prospectus, taking a look at those things, seeing the people that are coming, because, you know, I mean, I'm the anomaly, obviously. I'm not the everyday average person that's involved in the game from the outside. But, you know, when I turn on the draft and I see a Ed Howard or I see a Jordan Walker get drafted, I am automatically tuned in to that player no matter what, because there aren't enough of us. We're not at the saturation point yet where I can say, all right, I can't root for all of these guys individually, you know, but right now I truly can. I can almost follow every elite African-American prospect through the game and have more than enough bandwidth to pick up the ones who aren't elite as well. And I think that's the point where we got to see some of the change at with that. Mm-hmm. But two things I wanted to grab y'all before we get out of here, man, is that, you know, we were talking about this. We talked about Jordan Walker. I talked about, you know, we were when you made your announcement about getting ready to go to Vanderbilt early and about how they talked about Jordan and his family when he got drafted and how, you know, it was a thing that was really emphasized and put out there. But I think it's important to emphasize, you know, black parenting and what that looks like and the relationship between fathers and sons and fathers and daughters and mothers and daughters and everything as often as you can. And I think it's not put out there enough. So I asked both of y'all, you know, there's a lot more to go on the journey, but what's it been like for you two to, you know, share this together and to have that experience of coming up and, you know, instructing the game and watching the game and to go on some of the journey that y'all have so far together?
You know what? I've been privy to be able to experience this journey, you know, with my son and with our family. You can dream all day long. When it becomes reality and you're living it, it's a whole different situation. So I can't ever say that, in a million years, I thought that this is what that journey would look like. You never even think about that. But it's been extremely gratifying. It's always difficult when raising any young person, when you're raising your children, when you're raising a younger family member, when you're around that person all the time, when you are the adult and you are making a push to hold a young person accountable. I don't care if you're coaching, if it's your son or whatever. It can be challenging because we're all individuals and there's certain things that are going to challenge that relationship. But I will say this, you're not going to find a superstar. You're not going to find a successful person that did not have that person and did not have that core group around them coming up that were not holding them accountable, that were telling them it's okay to do less. You're going to have, in order to be successful, you have to have those people in your circle that aren't going to necessarily just tell you what you want to hear. They're going to tell you what they know you need to hear. And to Christian's compliment, I will say, he has taken criticism, he has taken information, and he has found a way to put it in his way and to do it his way. But to take that in and to continue to work on his craft and to take that to the next level. So it's been incredible. I mean, obviously we can't do it, you know, without mom. We can't do it without sister. We can't, you know, it's a group effort. Nobody makes it on their own. So we've been privy to be able to have a strong core and an extremely phenomenal supporting cast. And I think that it shows every time he goes out there and performs. You can see that investment of so many people into him. And so we definitely appreciate what he's been able to do with those blessings.
Two lies about success, that it happens overnight and that it can be obtained by yourself. It's impossible. It's never happened either way. So before we go, now, I promised that we weren't going to be talking about accolades and comparisons and all that. We're not doing that. But, Christian, I know you got a big game coming up here soon. So, you know, I just wanted to, you know, ask you a little bit about that experience and about if you can explain a little bit about the showcase that you're going to be a part of here shortly.
I'm going to the Under Armour All-American game, which this year is called the Baseball All-Star game. And basically just went on there with some of the top talent in the country. There's some other top black players down there, and Tyree Reed and guys like that. We're going to compete against each other in front of scouts, basically just good old-fashioned all-star game and try to do my thing.
Hear that. Well, listen, y'all, I appreciate y'all making time for to join the program. You know what I'm saying? You know, you definitely have my support, definitely always in your corner, you know, outside of just, you know, talking about things in this platform. So I appreciate both of y'all. Hope we can have you back to have some, you know, some more conversations about things like that. I think that a part that really gets lost in the middle for a lot of kids is just exactly how to get to a position where you can be going to college to play ball. And the key of that is going to college, you know, and having that experience too. So would love to have y'all come back and talk about that some more, man. But best of luck this weekend. And, you know, definitely stay blessed and stay safe, y'all.
Thank you.
Definitely appreciate it, Matt. Thank you for taking the time to, you know, shed some light on kind of what we got going on.
Absolutely. We're going to be right back after this to wrap things up on this episode of The Scenario Sports. And welcome back in to The Scenario Sports. I'm happy to have this segment here, and I'm happy for this to be on the second show because in a lot of ways, it does both things I want to do. It talks about where I've been personally, but also talks about where the show's going to be, where we're going, type of conversations that I want to have here. And I thought, what are the best places that I can start at? And one of the people that's on the short list of this was a guy that I've known for nearly 10 years now, if you want to feel a little bit old real quick with it. But we'll talk a little bit about that. My man right here, Jason Klingscales. Jason, what's up, brother? How you doing, man?
Hey, man. I'm good. I'm just trying to make it here, man. That's a crazy time, to say the least. NYC, good old Harlem, man. You know, it's you know what? I got to say, even though it seems chaotic, it's chaotic everywhere in its own right. I'm glad to be here in New York, man. I'm just glad to be home.
I hear that, man. I hear that. I know it's not been a couple of easy months here for you, to say the least, when it comes to just what life is and where it's at. And my heart goes out to the people in New York who, I think have boomeranged from this thing a lot better than a lot of other places in the country have. But I know it still is a process. And I know it's still something that's going on, man. So absolutely. But I don't want to drag it down. We know where that's at. There's plenty of things that we can go down with that. But, I'm glad that you were able to come on and talk about some of the things we had up front. But before we go down this pathway, I want to go back, and I talked about this a little bit on the first show. Go back to those early days, early days of Twitter, sports Twitter back in the day.
When it was fun.
Yeah, back when it was fun. Back when I didn't think for 10 seconds before I put anything out there. And then, God, probably 70% of the time, I just end up being like, you know what? It doesn't matter. I'm not. But back when, there were a lot of folks that were growing their careers through Twitter at that time, mm-hmm. and were really doing it in a way that was very exchange worthy, very conversational, and very back and forth. And I think that it brought a lot of people together that mm-hmm. otherwise wouldn't have. And I think that that kind of tells the story of, where kind of our years working together got started.
Yeah.
Because that would go back to, I couldn't, I'm not great with like, you know, some people do that thing where they say, you remember where you met me? I don't know. I don't remember at this point. I attribute it to Cream, and the Cream rising to where it needs to be. But
yeah,
we looked up, and it actually went through the program that you were running at that time, being the Exchange. Look at those words working together.
Yeah, man. I mean, long story short, I had hosted a podcast. Scratch that. It was a live show that was also a podcast. Let's not get that twisted. All you people who are doing podcasts now, it's great. But some of us are doing it live.
Yeah.
And
pitfalls that came with doing those things.
To quote the evil Bill O'Reilly, we're doing it live. Well, we did it live, but we had a lot of fun with it. Myself and one of my closest friends in the world, Sumit Dasgupta. It was a revival of a show we did in college. A college radio show we did back at our alma mater, Babson College. In suburban Boston. And we were like, hey, you know, I was sort of building a little bit of a profile in sports media, doing a lot of freelance work here in New York. He was back home in Boston and kind of, he had the itch to do something, but he wasn't really working in the sports world so much. And I kind of was. So it was like, well, why don't we just do our old show from college, but we're a little more grown up, which is still hilarious to say since we're now in our late 30s. But neither one of us are really grown up. So the Exchange came from that. And the Exchange was taking our sort of backgrounds. We both worked in the business world in different ways. I worked in the media business. I still do. But I worked in the business side of media for a while, but I was also a stringer for some outlets here in New York. And Sumit was passionate, former athlete himself, but passionate sports fan who knew that there was something more to say. And we just decided to build the show. And again, we wanted to come from more of a mature sort of point of view, trying to understand a little bit more of the business and talking about, well, the stuff we're talking about now on a sort of real-time basis every time now, the social issues and all that. So our show was built on that, in addition to the traditional analysis and all that. And we brought together a lot of really interesting guests, mostly I did, but we brought together a lot of really interesting guests, and that's where you came along, Mr. Whitener. And even before that, you know, you were sort of in a periphery. But I was able to sort of, with Sumit, we were able to build this show that just, I guess, like, in a way, I don't want to say it's ahead of its time, because it's not as if we were, like, the biggest show in the world. We definitely weren't. But I do feel like we were addressing things that are now regularly talked about. And, Sumit and I were talking about this the other day, because we were thinking of doing something, now again. And it's like, we were a little bit ahead of the game for a lot of folks. We did a show like a year, like the 1 year anniversary of The Decision. Mm-hmm. And that got a huge bit of traction with us, with folks, because we knew the expected angles from the other places, such as ESPN and the like. We knew the expected angles for even some of these independent outlets. But for us, it's like, listen, let us sit down and really have some really interesting discussions with it. A friend of mine, Michael Tillery, was on that, and he was a great guest. And we talked about any and every angle you possibly can with it. And that was sort of like, again, a little bit of ahead of some of these other folks. So, and we kept trying to do that. And we had some good momentum. We did that for about 4 years. But life happened, as life always happens with us, you know, when it comes to, you know, moving, jobs, marriage, kids in my case now. But it was a great 4-year run, and but it was also a combination of so many other things I was doing outside of my 9-to-5, and a great way to bring a great friend of mine into the fold. And also, just like yourself, Matt, meeting a lot of great people from that, whether they were listeners or they were guests, people who just thought differently about the games. And where, again, as now it seems like everybody's thinking differently about the games, that really wasn't the case when we were doing it in, like, say, 2014, 15, 16, and all the like.
Well, so it's funny. It's very, yeah. And it's interesting that you bring up the decision, because I feel like when I look back at that era, and I kind of consider the era of me getting started was probably 2009, 10, you know, so yeah. I was rolling by that time. But I remember the decision coming around, and the decision was the summit of a completely different type of offseason in general, you know, yeah. Because free agency, you know, the way that, you know, Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh and Amari Stoudemire, and go back to a guy that didn't end up moving, but was in that mix, Joe Johnson, mm-hmm. Carlos Boozer, all these different guys going into that market at the same time. And, oh, by the way, LeBron James, who I think that in that moment when he showed that power that he had in the decision, it changed sports commentary on the other side. And I think it made people look at the business in a different way than they ever had. So I don't think you're wrong in saying you're ahead of the game, because that was something that was being – there was only a couple people talking sports business, and they were all just like on ESPN on occasion.
Right. And I think for us it was, you know, look, you know, myself, a black kid from New York City, you know, Sumit being this Indian-American kid from the Boston area who was so attuned into the sports world, which is in the United States predominantly, you know, on a professional level, predominantly black. Mm-hmm. So we were sort of attuned to – the cultural sense, and us having, you know, the conversations and the connections with people who worked in the business side, and with myself working in the media realm as well, I felt like when we had that show, we had to say something different than, let's talk about all the people who burned the jerseys, right? Or let's talk about, you know, Dan Gilbert and the infamous letter. It's like, okay, we can do that rehash and all this stuff, and that's fine. But as you mentioned, the entire business of sports, not just the games themselves, because listen, that was the most impactful that's arguably the most impactful offseason of a professional sport in the history of sports anywhere. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the business of media, how it impacted, you know, the business of media was really fascinating. The fact that certain people were able to build their names off of being these contrarians and build their names off of being like these anti-LeBron contrarians in particular. Yeah. So yes, while people talk about Skip Bayless for the most part, there's also Scott Rabb, who is like this culture writer who wrote a couple of books about LeBron, you know, and went from, I think it was a book called The Whore of Akron, to suddenly when he came back, all of a sudden kind of, excuse my French, kissing his ass afterwards, a few years later. It spawned a lot of that. And you saw that a lot of websites all of a sudden started trafficking in that sort of anti-LeBron sentiment. That was certainly racist, but there was also like this, there's this tone of, there was this larger sort of sense of, let's take this divide between the fans and the players and just exasperate it at a different level, because here's a guy who created this entire elaborate scheme to tell everybody where he was going to go. And it just fed more into that player fan resentment. And a lot of websites and a lot of bloggers and a lot of tweeters now and all this stuff really built the names off of playing in that realm, whether they were for the move or against the move. And there was a lot of people against the move.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But like, that's the thing. It was like so many careers were kind of built off of that. Even if it wasn't directly off of LeBron, it was off of feeding into that frenzy. You know, and then because the players are all of a sudden able to speak for themselves a little bit more because of social media, it just fanned the flames even further. And yeah. I think there were a lot of places that I think if we look now in 2020, I think if you look at some of these websites, you look at some of these outlets that were able to build their own brands, indirectly they were built off of the decision because they knew that they can sort of traffic in this field of fan resentment, of hate, as well as support, like this blind support. Listen, let's not lie. There are a lot of blind LeBron fanboys and fangirls and whatever else who are going to follow anything he does just because he is who he is. And yeah. There were plenty of outlets that fed into that as well. So well, that's,
and I think that when you talk about that element of it, that's an interesting thing. That was something I actually wanted to talk with you about. I'm going to put a pin in it so we can put a pin in some other things I want to talk about. Because while we're here in the neighborhood, let's just get into it. Yeah. You know, we fast forward, what, 9 years now from the decision at this point?
10 years.
10 years, yeah, I guess so. 10 years at this point. And it seems like that was LeBron version. How many versions of LeBron do you feel we're on, first of all? Because I'm going to say LeBron version 4.5, and I'll justify the 4.5.
I think that's fair. I think it's fair.
I think that first 8 years in Cleveland, if I'm remembering accurately, you know, from the draft day until when he left, was version one. And it had seasons, but it was all one version. That was him, you know, following, I think, what I will call the established NBA narrative of you're drafted to a team, you take that team to prominence, get your roses, and you keep doing that. And LeBron, I think genuinely, with the exception of perhaps Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who it gets lost in the mix a little bit that Kareem took his destiny into his own hands.
He did do that.
And Wilt Chamberlain did too, to an extent. And I think that LeBron's career has begun to start modeling a little bit more of Wilt's than Kareem to me, but I'll come back around to that though. Just from the sake of using his own platform to get to where he wants to get, exercise and skill. But so that version two obviously was the Heatles, if you will, era.
LeBron personally.
It was absolutely one of if not the most remarkable version of a basketball player I've ever seen was that version. Mm-hmm. So here's the kicker though. Here is the 0.5 for me is the return to Cleveland. Because that was a extension of the first era, I feel like. I think it was an extension of the first era. It was just a picking up where he left off. It was an unfinished business in the middle of a career.
Sure.
And I don't think there's any other athlete I can think of that took an unfinished business stint in the middle of a career and then got back to what he was going to do anyway.
Yeah, he did. Listen, I've always respected what he was able to do off and on the court. I do think that, you know, his detractors and his acolytes are a bit too much, but I've always respected what he was able to do because he knew his own weight and he knew his own power and he knew that everything was going to move when he moved. And for him to decide, hey, listen, I'm not going to do the swan song in Cleveland at the end. I'm going to do it now because I'm at my full power as an athlete. We're not going to talk about the off-court LeBron. I'm at my full power as an athlete. In my opinion, and I'm sure some people are going to disagree, I always thought that the best version of LeBron we ever saw was in Miami, and as a player. I still feel that way, even though he's been able to slightly tweak himself over the years. I've always felt like the best LeBron on the court was in Miami.
I don't see how anybody could see him play at any other stage and not think that was the case. Even if you took Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh off that team, just the combination of what he was as a basketball player at that point was incredible.
Yeah, he was still a superb defensive player. I think he is still, you know, he has his moments, as we've seen over the last couple of years, where he's not as strong defensively, but he can still
get things done. Do you think he's not as strong or he's not as interested?
Both.
Because I feel like he's at a weird place where he goes into that shift work phase a little earlier than some other guys we saw. Because, I mean – I think about how many guys you've seen play that didn't go into that phase at some point. I would be challenged to figure out any.
Well, I would only say this with him. It's that, again, the reason why I think in Miami he was the absolute peak, the absolute apex of a player, was that there was also a little bit of personal rage within him that pushed him. I think we underestimate that. First of all, to be a great defender in any sport, you have to be a tremendous athlete, even better than the other athletes. You're not going to see a guy who was a schlub, and I say that relative, who's a big, great athlete. No. LeBron was at his peak physically, and even though he's always been this amazing physical player, but there was a little bit of rage within him that on time, even though, yes, he was having fun with his boys, he was having fun with Wade, he was having fun with Bosh, he was having fun watching the player moving around the league and seeing what he and his cohorts inspired, but there was always that, you know, with how Cleveland ended, with how he left Cleveland, and there was that sort of sentiment. There was the hate of the Boston Celtics. There was this idea of like, yo, I got my boys now, and they're going to help me win. Mm-hmm. So, and ain't nobody gonna stop me. If you try to stop me, we're gonna burn this motherfucker down. And that was within him that made him such a great defensive player, where it was just 48 minutes or 53 minutes if it was overtime. Now, yeah, he picks and chooses his spots because he's learned a little bit of player management. You know, he's learned from his mistakes that also took place in Miami and Cleveland. But he's also learned, listen, I'm going to let these other guys run things. I'm going to let them sort of – that's what he's doing with AD. And that's why people talk about AD, Anthony Davis, being Defensive Player of the Year. Everything's going to funnel through him in some sort of degree. And knowing that he had a backup in Dwight Howard, that can kind of help things out there too.
Yeah,
he doesn't have to run the defense. So whereas in Miami, which was already a really good defensive team before he arrived, let's not forget this. Wade was an exceptional defensive player at shooting guard. Mario Thomas was not a bum at point guard. They had a pretty good defensive system in Miami, but he just took it to a different level. Whereas now, if you're asking a question of like, does he dial it back some? Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
This year, he has to. He's, yeah. You know, he's in his later 30s now. He doesn't have to run things as much. He's more focused on just sort of facilitating the offense and having his guys sort of do that and have everything sort of being curtailed that way. It's not that he can't turn things up, and we saw that against the Nuggets where, you know, he decided I'm going to take on Jamal Murray and mostly shut him down with a couple of fouls. But I do think that LeBron has a moment where, you know, some of it is age and that's relative, let's be honest. But then I think also it's I'm going to turn on when I need to. When things aren't getting done on the other side of the court, you know, on the other wing,
mm-hmm.
I got to do this.
Yeah.
And he still has it within him to do it. And it's not coming from this place of rage, whatever else. It's not coming from this place of like, I got to prove you I can do this. I got to prove to the world what I can do. This is now on the whole, yo, I want my chip. And all right, let me just get out of bed. All right.
And I think I shorted my own point right there when I talked about this being version 5 LeBron, because I do want to spend some time talking about what's ahead, what we just saw, and then what's ahead in the NBA Finals too.
Yeah.
Is that he's version 5 LeBron to me right now, because version 1 was all of Cleveland, like I said. Version 2 to me was year 1 in Miami, which he showed up to me, and I think that he thought it was going to be a little bit sweeter than it was.
You know, I agree.
Showed up, and he was still Cleveland LeBron. He was just in Miami. And it wasn't going to be that. I think that year, was that 2010-11 season? Or 11?
That was 10-11. That was when he lost to Dallas.
2010-11 season. That was the year that LeBron grew up, I think. I think he officially grew up that year. That was version 2. Version 2 lasted for 1 year. Version 3 was the rest of the run in Miami. He was a different man that second year through the last year in Miami. He just was.
I would agree with that, because I always think back to that, you know, final series, and a lot of people, first of all, I don't think Dallas as a team gets enough credit for what they did.
Oh,
I think it was.
I'm glad you brought that up because we're about to talk about that.
I think a lot of people like to believe that all of a sudden this was like, you know, Miami falling apart. No, Miami didn't fall apart. Miami just got outplayed.
Yes.
Dirk Nowitzki was on a whole nother level. And I think that there was some motivation from your previous flights when it came to the final series 5 years before. There was also the whole, the cough gate, if you will, between, you know, Wade and James and then Nowitzki. It was a properly built team at the right time. And I think Miami was still just getting things together. They had enough talent to push through, but I think Dallas really was the better team.
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do too. Which would see, for me to wrap up that point, is to be that version 3 was the rest of Miami. Version 4 was the point version was the return to Cleveland. He was a different player then. He was a different guy. I think he really, for the second time, took his power of the entire league into his hands at that point. But I think he did it more intentionally than ever when he went back to Cleveland. That was like one of the strongest flexes I've ever seen. And then with that final version being the current one we're seeing right now in L.A., and that chapter is still writing itself. But sure. I want to talk about L.A., the Lakers, mm-hmm. and LeBron and what that all means, because it's a lot more than LeBron. LeBron is the conversation is here, but this has been something I've been thinking about with this whole thing. I think it's lost in the mix a little bit. Anthony Davis. Now, you know, it's legitimate debate who – I think that the conversation of who is the most impactful and who is the best player on the Lakers are two different things. I think that at this point in his career, Anthony Davis is the most skilled player, but LeBron is still the most impactful. Him being there, if he was not there, the Lakers would not be here. However, if Anthony Davis was not there, the Lakers would not be here. So it's
– I think that if you take one of them out of the equation, then the Lakers are a lower seed team. Playoff team, absolutely, but a lower seed team. I think this was LeBron realizing that, you know, this is the best big man he's ever played with. And let's keep in mind, I still think in some ways Chris Bosh is sort of undersold. I think Bosh is a tremendous player.
Let me ask. Let me jump on that real quick. Is this the best player that LeBron has ever played with?
That's a really great question. I don't know. If you ask me today, I'll say no. If you ask me tomorrow, I'll say yes. I say no in that, you know, and AD has done a remarkable job so far, but this is still his first significant postseason run. Mm-hmm. And this is also still his first run with a player of a similar caliber. And I think there is a mentality that also has to be embraced with that too. Mm-hmm. The reason why I would say Chris Bosh is the best big man he's played with. Wade may have been the best player, although I also have my – I think Wade also benefited from having great players around him, as great of a player as he was. I still think people forget that Wade wouldn't have won without Shaq or LeBron or Bosh, or, you know, he wouldn't have won a championship at all.
Sure.
But I think that with Bosh, who obviously wouldn't have done a lot of things without, you know, his own teammates, Bosh also had this sort of mentality of, I knew what it was like to carry a team and to not go as far, but I knew when I came somewhere what my role was supposed to be and yes. how I can fit this in a scheme of a really good defensive team. Eric Spoelstra is one of the best coaches of this generation, and we're starting to see that now.
Yeah.
Wade is a generational talent, a shooting guard. Again, this team has a really good system. And Pat Riley, listen, I'm a Knicks fan. I'm not supposed to say these words. Pat Riley is a freaking genius, always has been. I'm never going to – I could say bad things about Pat Riley, but I recognize the gangster right away. Mm-hmm. Bosh came into the system saying, like, all right, I know whose show this is going to be. If y'all let me do my job,
Bosh was the right type of superstar to put together in that situation. Yeah. Here's the thing that gets lost up and think about that Heat team. And I swear I didn't mean to stay with those Heat this long. But
it's got
much to do with the series that we're about to face. Is that Bosh was – when you hear people talk about big threes and people talk about putting together these things, and I think that we're moving out of the big three era some, especially with what we've seen the returns be here in this NBA season. But when you put together a big three, if you're going to have three separate superstars in it, you have to have one superstar in it who's willing to step down. That's why a lot of these teams haven't worked. Bosh could have stayed anywhere and got top flight numbers. He kept making all-star teams. But to your point, he was a superstar who was okay with playing not just second fiddle, but third fiddle, and very clearly fit into that place. And that was essential to making that work.
But also, it was essential for them even to win in the first place because, look, you know, Wade wasn't that great in that first final series, you know, of the Heatles era.
None of them were. Definitely LeBron wasn't.
And then even, like, when they won their first championship against Oklahoma City, you saw that Bosh was the difference maker. You saw that he was the guy who can actually – he was the stretch player. He was the guy who can go low. He can go high. Mm-hmm. He made the shots. He rebounded, which I think people overlook how important that is, a guy who you know who's going to get the boards. But he was a reliable option. He, you know, he had just such tremendous range as a player. You know, he had a gifted shooter. He could bang if he needed to. He did all that stuff. He really was the guy who did the dirty work. He just happened to be a little bit more refined in doing so. And I think that you saw the difference in the team when he was on the floor and when he was off the floor. And so going to your original question about AD, AD's now going through this run the first time. And, you know, him being younger at the time, him being younger than Bosh when he's going through this run, I think allows for the perception of him being the best player. But I think still in a mental sense, and let's be for real, like, I think Miami Heat are going to be a fascinating series, but I think that it's not as if he's going to go against a caliber. He's not going to go against a team of a similar caliber that those Heatle teams did. You know, OKC had that big three and some good depth. You know, the Dallas team, as we talked about earlier, was like, you know, much better than people realized.
That's one of the deepest championship teams of the last 20 years.
Absolutely. And then San Antonio being San Antonio towards the end of their peak powers and still with Kawhi on that court, Kawhi Leonard on that team. So I think with AD, you know, he's not going against a similar team that has like those kind of mega powers, if you will, aligned. And so he can potentially dominate, but we're not going to see really how strong he's going to be in terms of legacy building. until the next time the Lakers go to the finals against another team that may be similarly stacked or close to it. Bosh was going against teams that had something, and he was the answer, you know?
Yeah.
It was – and I think that's where, again, today I'll say Bosh is the best big man that LeBron has played with. Tomorrow I'll say it's AD based on the sheer talent that he has. And if he actually felt like playing the five, if he actually felt like playing the pivot, he could be a great pivot man if he wanted to.
Sure.
Bosh was able – he was willing to do that at times. And that's something that AD doesn't want to do. So
that's the thing I wonder about Anthony Davis when I look at it. And I'm not one of those people that gets caught up into, you know, you didn't do it yourself, so it doesn't count. Because let's be real, nobody ever won a title by themselves. So I'm not getting it. And what's the smarter play for Anthony Davis, to hang around in New Orleans forever or to get somewhere where he's got a chance to compete? You might as well make your best basketball days count for something. And he's doing that right now. I'm not holding that against him at all.
Right.
Here's the thing, though. When you look around the league and you look at the guys who are driving, you know, at top speed, if you will, you know, we watched this happen with Giannis. Giannis is in, you know, the second half of a back-to-back MVP run that he's at, whether you agree with it or not. It's not like he's any worse than the third best player in the league, no matter how you feel about him and his where he's at right now. But does Anthony Davis take a step back in that hierarchy at all because of the fact that he's at his peak powers, but he already took that acquiesce and moved into a role with another guy? Or is that just, you know, a bygone era of somebody staying out of the mix for that long before they move into a but join up. Let's put it that way.
I just think that, first of all, Davis is – and I think he just saw what seemed to be a no-win situation with the Pelicans, especially with – listen, let's keep in mind, he was there, and it was an ownership change, and, you know, that ownership, the Benson family, you know, obviously lost the patriarch, but I think that there's something to be said about a team that – ownership that, while they may have two teams, their real love is the football team and the Saints, not so much the Pelicans.
Right.
And I think he probably – I think there's some other – and I can be wrong – obviously, I'm not in Louisiana, but I think there's something to be said about understanding that sort of situation and him asking himself, well, based on what the next few off seasons are going to look like, and, you know, when can I pull the escape hatch, and where can I go? I think he just saw the best possible situation was with the Lakers team that still had some room to bring him on. This isn't like the Lakers were capped out and had to move a bunch of they moved a lot of guys, but they didn't move a lot of guys that cost a lot of money. And would have hamstrung, you know. This is a case where it's like, you know, this could be done and it can be legal within the cap system. Otherwise, if I just wait to play this next year out, then the only teams that were going to be able to make a move for me and I can get my money were teams that aren't that good, such as, obviously, the Knicks. So it was, I'm going to move myself to a contender and use the leverage of the system that's in front of me to do that. And it's all going to be, you know, on the up and up. This isn't going to be some crazy situation where, you know, both teams can be penalized, but I got to make the move and make the move now. So in terms of the larger conversation about, you know, because he didn't do it by himself, does that, you know, diminish his place in the hierarchy of great NBA players? I don't think so, only because I think what the situation is in front of him with the Pelicans and the Lakers, he just, you know, and all these guys, especially these top tier guys, they all know the business so much better than the predecessors who knew the business but were really hamstrung. These guys know the business in a way that no one else has ever known before. And I think that is the reason why all this is happening. And to me, that shouldn't take away from who he is as a player on the court.
Sure.
I think, you know, in terms of the skill set, in terms of what he could do and all of the stuff. And listen, he was still playing in the Western Conference. It's not like he was going to the Eastern Conference where it was a different schedule, if you will. And you're seeing different players you're seeing some teams more than others. You know, he's still staying in the Western Conference. He was still seeing the same teams on a certain, on a regular basis. You know, this isn't like it is, you know, technically in baseball where you go to another league and you potentially see whole new players.
Yeah.
You know, this was a place where he knew who he was dealing with. So I think that that's why also the skills don't need to be ranked, you know, any differently because he moved away.
Yeah,
I think this is more a business thing rather than, you know, the machinations of how we like to rank players based on our own sort of perception.
Our own criteria. That has absolutely, that shifts from one person to the other. And I think that most of the time people spend more time arguing about the criteria of a top 10 player as opposed to what truly one is. Because at the end of the day, when you talk about it, it's just basically reshuffling the same. If we talk about top 10, it's reshuffling the same 12 people just in different roles. And then two people get left out. You make a big deal about that. But it doesn't really matter 10 to 1 in the NBA at any point.
It's recency. It's all about recency. And if we, especially if we got to see you play extra games after regular season, that's going to play a massive role. Because look, right now, do you still say that? And again, you know me personally. I've never been big into these rankings of like top whatever else. But
you've shut down many pieces that have people proposing to talk about things like that in your life, in your life as a editor, and then later as an editor in chief. So
right, but then also, like, do you say to yourself, okay, the Warriors were absolute trash this year? Is Steph Curry still not one of the top 10 players in the league because the team is trash? Absolutely not.
It's all about recency bias.
Yeah, that's all it is.
So all right, so let's real quick, before we shift into a couple other things, we wanted to clarify real quick. Let's talk about the NBA Finals. And I think that this is a styles clash that I'm excited to see. I love it.
I love it.
Because it's, for me, on one side, it is a last week on the show, I said that the Miami Heat are the Wu-Tang Clan. Yeah. It's just a bunch of rugged cats that don't necessarily fit in as individuals anywhere else, but together they're a force. And we're seeing it all work out there against a team in the Lakers, which is really interesting, you know, when you kind of look at what that team is constructed as, especially in the history of the teams that have been built around LeBron. You know, again, you don't have the hallmark of the other championship runs he's made has been the three really good players. I mean, the two other really good players, and then the really specific people on the other roles that are just shooters or whatever like this. Like this team, I look at this team, I think a great comparison, I said, it's like having the big Joker, the little Joker, and then your next card is like a 10, maybe, or like a Jack or something like that. Hey,
it's gonna be fun.
You're going to have to maneuver it against somebody that's, you know, holding a pretty strong hand. They could, if they just play their hand right and balance it out, could overwhelm that hand that's got Jacks and Jokers. But, you know, I think that if anything has been proven in the NBA, two things I'm going to say. Is that more often than not, don't bet against LeBron James unless he's playing against a squadron. And you can say what you will about LeBron going to the finals and not winning as often in her appearance as, say, a Michael Jordan or even a Magic Johnson, I think, at this point. But the one thing you can't say about him is that run-of-the-mill teams don't just take him out. And I think that goes back to the point that you made about the Mavericks. Because nobody's going to say that those Warriors weren't. You can say they were stacked. You can say what you will about Kevin Durant. I'm never going to agree with you. But you can say what you will. But those teams were, first of all, a historical anomaly in the NBA. And then number two, they were deep as hell. But the teams that weren't, you know, that didn't have that special talent, that one singular guy that could go back and forth with him, and the Warriors had two. Or a team that wasn't just, we're so deep, we have so many people and a top flight star, they haven't beat him. And those are some very significant things. And when I look at this Heat team, it's a lot of guys, but are they going to have the singular guy that can go over when you need it? And that's the biggest question that I have.
I look at the matchup, and the other thing that stands out to me about, you know, how this team is so different than the previous teams that James has been on, the guard play is not as strong. You know, there isn't that lead guard, because listen, say what you will about Kyrie Irving, but he knew he could just say, hey, Kyrie, take this over, and he got it, you know? You know, in Miami, obviously, we knew they had a dynamic backcourt with a, you know, future Hall of Famer in Dwayne Wade, and though in a guy who became a Hall of Famer in Ray Allen, you know, later on. I think what's interesting about this series is that, you know, LeBron is de facto playing three positions, you know, or sometimes four. He's playing point guard, shooting guard, small forward and power forward, you know.
I think he's doing more on this team than he even was in Cleveland.
Agreed. And I say that because, again, there isn't that, like, you know, there isn't the guy at the two, at the one or the two that he can rely on. Is just sort of like, can you handle the ball for a little bit? Let me take some players off. Let me play off ball a little bit. That doesn't really exist on this team. There's a lot of, you know, spare, I don't want to say spare parts, because, you know, these guys who've won before, well, Rondo, that is. But these are guys who can kind of get things done, but not get things done for a full 48. And I think what's interesting is this is going to be much more based on the size of the Lakers versus the relative lack of size with Miami in comparison. I think Miami's really interesting in that regard because, you know, Bam has been outstanding. Shout out to our friend Brian Fonseca, who wrote for the Sports Fan Journal earlier this year about how good Miami is going to be because of the change at center. But I think what's interesting about Miami is that they, while we're not talking about, you know, the most dynamic guards in the league, that backcourt is okay. That backcourt's going to challenge the Lakers a little bit. And, you know, there are going to be times where you see LeBron switching off between, you know, Dragic and Jimmy Butler at times and maybe, you know, whatever else. He has to move all that around because the Lakers don't have the consistent guard play to rely on in order to make that happen. Whereas Miami may not have the size, they could have the quickness that's going to challenge them. And I think that's what's fun. But to your point of like, you know, I don't know. I'm really fascinated by this series because, like, it, to me, it's a question of how much does the Lakers' size, you know, dictate the fate of the series. This is not going to be a sweep. I think it could be 6 games. If it's 7 games, it's awesome. And that'd be like the miracles of the sports gods for us. But I definitely think this is going to be a tougher series than people think with the Lakers. But I do think this is going to be one of those series where there are going to be games where the size absolutely matters. It's I'm going to throw AD at you. I'm going to throw Dwight Howard at y'all for a few minutes. JaVale McGee may not, you know, JaVale McGee has actually won before. He can actually get things done for a little bit. Let's not forget that.
How many people on the Lakers, are champions? They three?
I mean,
Rondo, LeBron, JaVale, who else are there any other? I feel like there could be some sneaky winners on there somewhere.
It's not so much winner. Right. Yeah. J.R. Smith. We can't forget that. But then also let's keep this in mind. Like there are also guys who've sort of been through the wars a little bit more too. I mean, Dwight Howard's been through it. You know, he's played on multiple teams, but he went to the finals. You know, he's done this stuff before. Yeah. You mentioned J.R. Smith, former Sixth Man of the Year, the guy who's, you know, obviously played with LeBron and has had those battles. But you know what? He's been in the playoffs when he was in Denver and in New York. You know, you have Rondo, who won with the Celtics and who's also been through it a little bit with the Pelicans for a little bit. Yeah. You know, he's had that experience too. So when people talk about the whole playoff experience thing, there's the difference of and let's not forget, Frank Vogel has had some experience as well when he had those runs with Indiana. And obviously a little bit of burn of Orlando. Spoelstra has much more in playoff coaching experience, if you will, than Vogel. But I do think there's something to be said about the Lakers' relatively, you know, greater experience in sort of these playoff runs than Miami, where, you know, even Butler hasn't gone this long. And no. Butler, you know, nobody's really had this kind of run except for the man people call Iguodala, Andre Iguodala. I think there's something there that's going to be very – and obviously Udonis Haslem, who doesn't really play.
His presence is a really important one, though. And I noticed – here's what I'll say about Udonis Haslem. I think the running joke now is just the fact about he's still in the league. Like, he's still in the league. He's still there. But, you know, having him on that bench during these games with your Tyler Heroes and your Duncan Robinsons and your Kendrick Nunns and your – Bam, you know, taking Bam, I'm sure he's had a lot to do with Bam's success throughout the year. You know, things like that. And even being able to tell Jimmy how to lead and to have that, you know, have that there. Iguodala and Haslem, I mean, those are really, really valuable guys that contribute a lot more than just what you see on the box score that are going to be valuable for the Heat.
Haslem obviously is a different kind of a player, but I think back to like, you know, when we were coming up in the, you know, coming of age in the 90s, even though we're 80s babies, coming up in the 90s, I think of Tree Rollins. People be like, what? No, Tree Rollins, people forget, was, you know, he was a player slash sort of an assistant coach.
Yeah,
you know, that was his official role. Like, he really was an assistant coach as well as a player.
He's serving that role that Juwan Howard served on those other Heat teams.
Exactly. Haslem has kind of been in that sort of realm, you know, and I love guys like that. Like, people don't think there's a whole lot of value there. There's plenty of value there. You know, Herb Williams, if you will. I mean, Herb Williams sort of did the same sort of things in the 90s after his prime ended with Indiana. He came in New York. He backed up Patrick Ewing and all this stuff, but he was always in the organization. But he was serving in that same role of sort of like, I'll play for you need me a little bit, but I'm basically an assistant coach. Right. And you saw him take that on when he became, you know, coach, in the NBA and the WNBA and all that, and WNBA as well. So, you know, that's where Haslam comes into play. Iguodala can still get it done. Obviously, we saw that, you know, this last series. I do wonder, though, in terms of the size, how that's going to play, because it's not as if there's a ton of size depth that they can go against with the Lakers. So, yeah. But in terms of the coaching and sort of the intangibles and whatever else that matter, like, you know, they're all over the place in this series. And I think that's going to make for interesting chess matches between the coaching staffs.
So we talked, you know, up front, we talked about those Mavericks and, you know, just what type of team that was and just how deep they were at that point. And that depth was what was required to beat a team that had that, just that top shelf talent that the Heat had at that time. When LeBron and Wade and Bosh and all those guys are at the top of their game. That Heat team was substantially more talented in as a totality than this Lakers team. And I would say that Mavericks team, especially with Dirk being on it, is more talented than this Heat team is. If this series had the traits of any other final series in recent memory that you can think of, how do you think it plays out?
I mean, as I said, I kind of feel like this is, I mean, it does feel kind of like, look, the Lakers are the heavy favorites, and they should be, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think when you have the
I think they're at plus 270 this morning.
Yeah, when you have the personnel that they have, and you have the experience that, you know, many of those individual players have, you know, they should be favored.
Yeah.
It doesn't discount what Miami is able to do. Listen, the Celtics, in some ways, maybe they overachieved a little bit this year. But I still think what the Celtics were able to do this past year, Boston Celtics did a great job. Even with some of the changes in the, you know, some of the changes on the roster, Miami, however, has been building this, you know, we're now, people started to sort of lampoon a little bit to say Heat culture, but there is something to be said about what they've been able to build over the years without having to trade a ton of guys for the win now mode. It was a steady hand at the top with Pat Riley and Mickey Arison as the owner. You know, what this Heat team has been able to do is just build upon foundations they've been sort of working on over the years. But they still need that extra oomph. They still need something else.
You know who they remind me of? That when you start talking about the culture and talking about being steady and staying in the mix, the St. Louis Cardinals. They're going to fool around and they're going to become that type of franchise where people start talking about them in cliches like that, and then people are going to start getting mad at them. Right now. Yeah. Right now, the Heat are kind of the people's champ for the people that, and I say the people's champ, the people that don't want to like LeBron or the Lakers. This is the perfect type of team for them. To say it's just a bunch of guys, you know, there's no superstar. And I think that when people look at that, they say, and if they win, it's going to give them just the biggest feather in their cap.
Listen, I think, here's the thing. I don't think this Heat team is going away. I mean, to that point, I mean, do they make it back to the finals next year? Well, we'll see what kind of season we have at all in the first place, and what kind of roster machinations they're able to make. Because I still believe they have some wiggle room in order to add a couple players.
But what this season does
is to say, yo, we're not just in the finals in this sort of crazy year. We win against the best. We've done what we can. Again, the series has to be played. But I think this is a place where Miami has – it's funny because this goes back to sort of my past life in terms of being a research analyst, you know, in the media business. People talk about big markets and this, that, and the other and all that jazz. Nobody talked about Miami as a media market until LeBron showed up. And then when LeBron left, people didn't think about them as much. But now, based on them being in the finals without, like, you know, the biggest names, if you will, I think this attracts guys in the future that want to come there.
Miami's underdog is Underdogville right now. The Heat are in the finals. The Marlins snuck into the MLB postseason.
Really,
I mean, just in one of the more stunning but underreported things, just because this MLB season has been crazy. And I'm not going to talk about that right now.
But that's and we can play media metrics and, you know, market size or whatever else. But the point of it is, like, you know, now based on them making the finals with this roster, with this construction, and in this situation because of COVID. I do think they make themselves a prime destination. When the Heat franchise began in 88 and all that stuff, people just thought about Miami as like, hey, it's Miami, it's South Beach, or whatever else. This team's going to suck, but we get to enjoy ourselves in South Beach, right? And then the Alonzo Mourning / Tim Hardaway era really started getting into earnest, and people realized, yeah, they're South Beach, but also this team's going to beat your ass. But it still wasn't that strong attractant, right? And then Shaq shows up, helps Wade get his championship. That's great. now we think about this as a legitimate franchise. The Hedl era began something different. There's been a little bit of a pullback because people didn't know what Miami was going to be. And you saw what they've been doing all along, that steady hand. They get to be a steady hand with an, and that city and that area, from everything I understand, because I've never been to Miami, unfortunately, but I know they absolutely love that franchise. They love what Pat Riley has done over the last, 20 plus years. And I think this makes them that premier destination again for any free agent going forward. Just because this is not the team you expected to make the finals, but they're making a run that has been impressive enough to attract free agents.
Well, it's a team that I think is easy to add to because it's
very much so.
It's very flexible in its approach, and it has a lot of different things. So real quick, because there are some other things we want to hit. First of all, I'm just going to put you on the spot. I'm going to ask you back next week. We got some other things we need to talk about.
I'm with it, man. Cool. As long as my kid doesn't interrupt me too much, I'm with it.
That is completely okay during the COVID era. I think everybody's doing everything with kids and pets and everything. We're completely different. This is supposed to be a studio show, and I'm doing it from the house. So I completely understand what that means. But
it's what it is,
last thing I want to leave you with, because actually by the time we get back together, the finals would be at least 2-3 games in, perhaps.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about what's going to be happening with that with Monday Night Football tonight. And the only reason why I want to bring that up is that we've got potentially what could really be the launching of another era of quarterback versus quarterback dynamics. And that's Lamar Jackson versus Pat Mahomes, the last two MVPs, the best team in the AFC versus the team that won it, versus the team that won the Super Bowl. A whole huge convergence around these two next generation quarterbacks who feel like they're the future, but they're very much the present, as you can see right now. But they both happen to be Black quarterbacks. And even 5 years ago, that would seem unfathomable for this type of hype to be around two people that weren't Tom Brady or Peyton Manning or Aaron Rodgers or that.
Right.
Now it is regular season week 3. And I know that you are one of the people I know that is the most against hyperbole in the world. Mm-hmm. But does this game carry any particular significance?
Absolutely. No. Listen, while I'm not big into hyperbole, I'm not big into it because it lacks a lot of context, and I think people tend to sort of jump on something for what they want it to be. No, this is actually one of the most important games in recent NFL memory. I have no problem saying that. It's incredibly important, first of all, for ESPN itself as a network. Like, Monday Night Football franchise has been up and down over the years, and this is the premier game they've been begging for. As a matter of fact, I know NBC is crying. The executives at NBC are crying because this is not a Sunday night game. Like, I imagine they're like, oh, my God. Like, they're losing their minds at Rockefeller Center right now. But this is important for ESPN because, this is the kind of game that they've been begging for since they got Monday Night Football back some years ago. And with this new, the changes they made over the years, is like, this is the game that can make people pay attention to us again on a consistent basis. And maybe we can still angle to get these kind of great games on our schedule going forward into the next few years of their broadcast contract. For the league itself, I think back to when the NFL was really going through, not that they're not going through a crisis right now, but when they were going through all their self-inflicted wounds when it came to domestic violence and when it came to the brain injuries, concussions, and all that jazz, that whole bad period from like 2016 until last year, right? I spoke to a reporter about, what the NFL really needed in order to sort of give itself a shot in the arm, despite, all the stuff that was going on. And I always felt like it needed just a change in guard when it came to the quarterback position. And to see how it's happened, has been, it's been beautiful, to be honest with you. Like, even if you're not an NFL fan per se, and people have their reasons why. The reason why people are looking into this is because, again, you mentioned Patrick Mahomes, you mentioned Lamar Jackson. The last few weeks we've had, there are 10 starting quarterbacks of Black descent in the NFL right now, which has never been the case in the history of the league. And, whether people like to believe this or not, I think we do watch sports through all the socioeconomic prisms. How we discuss them is what really gets things muddled, but we do watch it from that point of view. And there are going to be a lot of people, we'll see what the numbers are and all the jazz, but even that, who cares? There are going to be a lot of people who watch tonight's game because they really want to see history in action. The last two MVPs, they happen to have been Black. They couldn't be more different in terms of how they play the game at quarterback. but they've had such great success in what they've done in such a remarkable amount of time that people want to see, like, all right, this is finally changing the guard. These are the guys that we were looking to watch for years. These are the guys that are going to supplant. I think in terms of the viewership, the Tom Brady luster had lost its sheen a little ways ago. But these are the guys that we're talking about now in the Aaron Rodgers realm, where we talk about, like, the most exciting players in the NFL. It's these two guys. Yeah. We talk about Aaron Rodgers in that realm for a long time. And now it's, we watch Patrick Mahomes that way. We watch Lamar Jackson that way. Who else can we watch this way over the years? You know, these are the two guys that have supplanted that mantle while Aaron Rodgers is still doing his thing. So I think from the league perspective, it's incredibly important to see that, and especially to see that these are black quarterbacks doing that, because we've seen the history of the black quarterback over the last 50 years, and this belief that may still exist in some circles of, oh, they're not cerebral enough, they're not this, that, and the other. MVPs. You know, one of them has gotten the biggest contract in the history of professional sports.
And the other one's going to pass him up. So that's just
very, very quickly. And like, this is the new realm of the game. And in terms of the teams themselves, like, look, there's that, you know, if you ever been in these locker rooms, you know, I covered the Giants for a few years, and it was a privilege to cover the Giants for a few years. These guys get up a little bit. They get up a little bit more when they're facing some new talent. There's a little bit extra, despite whatever else is going on. You know, these guys are going to step up a different level in terms of their approach. There's just everything going to feel. It's going to be that extra energy. If you remember for a long time, because I believe the game is being played in Baltimore. I don't remember.
Yes.
All right, it's playing in Baltimore. Now it's unfortunate that we're not going to have a crowd at M&T Bank Stadium. But the Ravens always got a little bit up when it was Monday Night Football. They got the black uniforms. There was something that they just did. It's really unfortunate we don't have that kind of energy there tonight. But these are those games. This is the proof of that. Like, yes, I hate the cliche of big stage. But, like, the Ravens really believed in that when it came to Monday Night Football. And then you see it's the, you know, the reigning Super Bowl champs, former MVP. Offensive dynamo at coach and assistant coach, you know, when it comes to Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy. Let's not forget that. Like, you have all these elements at play, and these players really do get up for it. It's just extra energy. And so I think this game is going to be a lot of fun for people who are NFL fans, people who are football fans, people who are into the whole social aspect of the league right now. This is the game that everybody's been waiting for. It's unfortunate there's no crowd, but I do think that when we're watching at home, we're going to feel that same energy.
Sure. I'm feeling it a couple hours in advance. So, Jason, let everybody know where they can check you out at, man, where they can follow up on you at on the other side of this.
Hey, listen, the best way to do it is just find me on Twitter. I try to tweet a little bit more, but, you know, I don't tweet as much. A Sports Scribe, ASPORTSSCRIBE. That was the name of my old blog. You can find me on Twitter. I'm also, you know, the Sports Fan Journal. That's our sort of home station, if you will. I'm the editor-in-chief there. Big shout-out to the TSFJ squad there. And Decider, which is, you know, entertainment website, which I've been a contributor for. You will see random posts from me. Well, I shouldn't say random, but, like, I'm starting to step away from the sports realm a little bit over there. I do some stuff on kids programming, if you will. So it's – I'm 15, but if you really want to find me, just find me on Twitter. You can go ahead and talk smack about me, but just, you know, just make it a little nice if you can.
That's my job. I'm not letting people take that from me. So, Jason, I appreciate it, man. And again, in advance, man, look forward to touching base with you next week. I know we got a couple things we didn't get to here, but we'll be able to talk about, you know, a month of NFL action at that point. A couple of things we want to touch on regarding Michael Jordan in the racing game, Lewis Hamilton getting into it, what the bubble means, and just get into a little bit more of that sports business angle that I know is so close to your heart. So. Well, I appreciate you making the time for me here, though.
Hey, Matt, thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, brother. Thank you. All right. So I hope everybody enjoyed the show today, enjoyed the time that we had here. Again, thanks to Jason, and thanks to Chris and Christian for joining the program. Really going to be looking forward to hearing a lot more from him, from that young man as his career is going along. And also, you know, just keep an eye on there. I think it's important to keep an eye on, you know, where African-Americans are in baseball, because there's a lot that's being said, and I don't think it's getting seen as often as it is by, you know, the people in the NBA or even college athletes in other sports, you know, but they got something to say. And I look forward to continuing to hear it and see where it comes from, and make sure their voice is getting the recognition it needs as well. You know, usually we leave this space here for a little bit of a parting word, a parting take that we've got. I'm gonna tack that on to the end of the next show, because I want to kind of get to the rest of the conversation with Jason that we got here, because I know that we definitely have some things we want to do. So we'll get back into that for the next program. But again, thanks everybody for checking it out. Stay locked. Always, you can subscribe to all of the programs, both audio and video here. You can head over to YouTube, to the SOLC Network. Subscribe. You'll get all of our shows here that we've got through the feed there. Same thing for our podcast feed. You can get that anywhere that you check out your podcast at. Subscribe to the SOLC Network. And, you know, again, I'll check you out next time.